KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
When you're a really divisive figure in life, especially when you've, you know, led a revolution or you have a very controversial form of government, after your death, you know, your corpse can become a pretty potent symbol.
I've really had great success lately with evergreen huckleberries. The ones that I've planted in as plugs just a few years ago have really made dramatic growth.
I'll have the summer to enjoy sweet peas, and by golly, there are going to be millions of them. I will tell you right now.
Our gardeners getting excited for gardening. Also, that was Bess Lovejoy, you heard, a writer and researcher, editor based in Seattle, talking about what happens with famous corpses as our theme on death continues this hour on Weekday. But we're going to start with what is happening with Seattle Police and the Monitor's report on reforming the police department. In the PI, there was a nice lead. Two Seattle police unions deployed both steel fist and velvet glove when they announced their suit to block the Monitor's plan that would reform the training of Seattle police. Rich O'Neill is president of the Seattle Police Guild, Seattle Police Officers Guild. He joins us on the phone. Rich O'Neill, thank you for taking the time.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
What is your complaint? What is behind this suit?
Well, I have to correct just the lead in there real quickly. We are not attempting to block the Monitor's actions or plans.
Oh.
This is not about opposing police reform. Both the Seattle Police Officers Guild and the Management Association, we represent the officers and sergeants. Management has the lieutenants and captains, and it's pretty unique that both groups would come together. But both groups felt that we were getting some mixed messages on how these reforms are going to be implemented. For instance, throughout this entire process, we've been open and transparent with the DOJ, with the U.S. Attorney for Western Washington, Jenny Durkin, met with her many times, and we were very comfortable with her conversations, and what she told us was that the state law is respected by the Department of Justice, and the state law in regards to collective bargaining, meaning that if reforms need to be bargained, they will be bargained. We got the same message from Mayor McGinn, Pete Holmes, the city attorney, members of the city council, all saying they respect unions' rights and they respect the laws of Washington. But now enter the Monitor and the Monitor's team, many of whom have experience. They are experts, I will say that, very distinguished, but their expertise comes in California. California has a much weaker collective bargaining laws, much weaker unions' rights, and it is not Washington. We've pointed this out many times, but there seems to be, I don't know, some confusion as to how you go about implementing change and reform. All we are saying is that we want the court to make it very clear. The Superior Court, we're asking in the declaratory judgment action to say simply that the City of Seattle still must comply with the RCW state law, and they must negotiate those items that are considered a mandatory subject of bargaining. And let me just say, not everything in the reforms, most of them, for instance, do not need to be bargained. Sending officers to training, adding more supervisors, I commend the monitoring team on those. They don't need to bargain that. It's not a mandatory subject of bargaining. But when they start getting into officers' rights, when they start getting into disciplinary changes, those things have traditionally always been bargained, and we want them to be bargained going forward.
But, Rich O'Neill, I mean, you're going before a different judge, so you are, it doesn't sound like you're feeling you're part of the process by which the judge involved in this lawsuit is dealing with these issues. So that it does sound like you're challenging the process.
No. Not at all. The City of Seattle entered into this agreement with the Department of Justice voluntarily. They did not go to court, for instance, fight it out and lose. They entered into this in a voluntary agreement to avoid a lawsuit. So they entered into this voluntary agreement, and now we want to make sure that the state law is respected, regardless of what voluntary agreements our employer, the City of Seattle, enters into. So it's really quite simple. The reason we choose Superior Court is because that is where the state law is governed. That is where the state law, we get our authority from the state law. Just because a federal judge is overseeing this agreement that the City of Seattle and the Department of Justice entered into, we feel that the state law is what is needs to be respected, and that's why we chose Superior Court.
Can you be more specific of where you think this reform plan violates state law?
Well, in the plan especially, the plan mentions, I think on page, it's either 5 or 6, it talks about any future subsequent collective bargaining agreements cannot have any provision in it that differs from the plan. Now, there's a number of different ways you can read that. Our reading of it is pretty much the monitor is saying in the plan that they want to limit what the city will agree with the unions on in future contracts. I mean, this is kind of some scary stuff to anyone who is a member of a labor union. They are limiting what the city could enter into an agreement with us. That, for instance, you can go ahead and agree on a new collective bargaining agreement with the union, but nothing in it can differ from the monitor's plan. And a lot of the plan is very vague. There's not specifics in it. It's going to be a living document that's going to move and grow as the circumstances change. And all we're saying is that we are for police reforms. There are things on the police department that need to be reformed. But when something touches on a mandatory subject of bargaining, we want it brought to the bargaining table. And, you know, the Seattle way has always been working in a collaborative fashion. Mayor Nichols came up with a blue ribbon panel that came up with 30 recommendations a number of years ago for changes to the police system. Every one of them was implemented. They were negotiated at the bargaining table. There wasn't this attitude that we're just going to kind of force it through or ramrod it through. They were brought to the table and negotiated.
Who has that attitude?
I believe in conversations that I've had with the monitor and some of the monitor's team, again, that they don't understand clearly the bargaining rights of unions in the state of Washington, and they are relying on their experience in California, which has a totally different set of laws and standards. And again, like I said, we've had mixed messages. The mayor, the city attorney, the U.S. attorney for Western Washington have all said they respect the law and they're going to bargain it. But then along comes the monitoring team, who now seems to act like they don't have to.
What impact do you think this challenge has on relationship that SPD, which has to open up its computer files, open up its doors, will have with the monitors, if any?
Oh, I don't think it will affect the police department as a whole, and the officers that are out there dealing with the monitoring team and having them do ride-alongs and whatever are being very nice and cooperative with them. They just want everyone to get on the same page and realize if we want to reform the department, let's all work together. I salute Connie Rice, who was hired by the mayor to come in and kind of give her expertise and bridge the gaps in many areas with the city attorney, with the mayor. You know, I think maybe she could have a role here in explaining to everyone, like, why do we want to fight these things out legally? Why don't we just get in a room, get the bargaining table, and work out those things that need to be bargained?
Give me, again, if you would, in most specifics, where you think this reform plan, as it's currently laid out, this living document, violates your collective bargaining rights?
Well, again, it is vague. So we are wanting to protect it moving forward. But like I said, the comment there about future collective bargaining agreements, there's also a comment in there about the Community Police Commission becoming a powerful policy-making body. Well, that's in direct opposite of what has been stated the mission of the Community Police Commission will be. It's going to be an advisory body that will investigate and advise the mayor on issues, but they will not be a powerful policy-making body. Now, if that is the plan, for instance, that would be touching on an officer's disciplinary rights, and that would need to be bargained. And I'm not saying just because something needs to be bargained doesn't mean it's being opposed. It just means if you want it, you have to bargain it.
What? I get you. How does officer discipline proceed today? And then I'm going to ask you, or you can just tell me, how do you see it proceeding under this plan that you're concerned about? How does it proceed today, officer discipline?
Well, I mean, for about the past three or four contracts, Article 3 in our contract, which is posted online, deals with all of the officers' rights when it comes to disciplinary hearings. These things have been painstakingly bargained back and forth. Every time we have a new contract, they're being bargained back and forth and changes made. This monitoring plan isn't very specific as to how or if they even want to change that. We are basically stating that any changes that involve a mandatory subject need to be bargained. And we don't want to go down this road where we're arguing it down the road as each one comes along. We want this declaratory judgment to clearly put everyone on the same page. And I wish it wasn't necessary. I still wish and I still hope that, you know, we will do it the Seattle way, where everybody gets together and sometimes agree to disagree, but let's all work together in getting this reforms done so that the police department can get out from under the consent decree.
But as you said, you in your press release and what you said today, you were getting what you said were mixed messages between DOJ, Jenny Durkin, Mike McGinn, Pete Holmes, Bruce Harrell, City Labor Relations Unit. You think this declaratory judgment by the judge would give you at least some clarity?
Absolutely. And those people you just named were all on the same side. They were on our side. They were basically saying that, you know, the RCW needs to be respected and the laws should be followed. And then we just want to make sure that the monitoring team is operating on that same viewpoint.
Have you looked at other consent decree and their outcome and how they have affected police officers' rights under collective bargaining?
Yes, every state has its own set of collective bargaining laws. But in L.A., for instance, a judge did rule in the Ninth Circuit almost 10 years ago that they had a right to be part of the process and to not just kind of roll over and accept whatever reforms are coming, but that they had an integral role in that. And again, that's in California, where the union rights laws are much weaker than in the state of Washington. You know, the guild didn't write the law. The state law is what it is. And this protects all unions, not just police unions, fire unions, public safety unions. Every union that operates in the state of Washington is covered under those laws. And we just want them respected.
You know, Rich O'Neill, besides that, your assessment of the reform plan and what you have seen laid out, what do you think?
Well, you know, so far we've had a couple of good conversations with Mr. Bob and his team. I found them to be very professional. Again, I think that there's going to be very few things that we probably even argue about. I commend them for their acknowledgement that we're very understaffed and we need a bunch more supervisors out there. I personally believe if we had proper supervisory staffing, you know, maybe some of these high-profile incidents never would have happened. Who knows? I also commend them for their acknowledgement that we need to train officers better. We're all for that. Absolutely behind those reforms, 100%. But we have to draw the line when it comes to officers' rights. Because if the union doesn't protect them, who will?
But isn't that where you're gonna clash here? Whether all critical force incidents, including officer-involved shootings, are thoroughly examined by the SPD from the perspective of the criminal and civil law, administrative policy, tactics, strategy, and training, along with an appraisal whether new policies or training should occur. That's one of their core requirements of the settlement agreement. Isn't that right where you end up with collective bargaining issues or police rights?
It could be. I mean, just that statement you read, I agree with that. I want things thoroughly investigated. I want things to be examined from all angles. We have nothing to fear there. The officers do their job, and they do it well. When an officer does not do their job well, they should face sanction. But what those sanctions would be, how the sanctions are carried out, the process, those are all outlined in our collective bargaining agreement, and if they want to change those, that's what needs to be bargained.
One of the things that the plan sets up is this process by which we're going to look at use of force issues. When you talk about the process needs to be bargained, I guess I'm trying to figure out what that means. What does that mean for the individual officer in the future as opposed to now if a use of force question comes up?
Well, I mean, officers are not that complicated. They want to know clearly what's the rules, and let's have them clearly established, and let's have them clearly laid out. Let's have the officers clearly trained on what they are expected to do in any given situation. And then when the officer does that, you know, that they are backed, so to speak, that someone will not, try to dismiss the officer if they follow their training and if they follow the way that the policy has been laid out. But we want it clear. We want it clearly laid out because lately, over the last few years, we've had a lot of quote-unquote Monday morning quarterbacks jumping in and jumping out saying this should have been done, this could have been done. But then when you look into the matter, the officer did follow their training, and they did follow their procedure. Not all the time. We do have officers that make mistakes, but we just want it clearly laid out for the officer. But we are not opposed, and I want to say it again, we are not opposed to reforms. We're not opposed to reforming our use of force policies, and we are not opposed to any more training. But we just want those issues that the courts have long ago determined to be a mandatory subject of bargaining in this state to be respected while the monitoring team operates in this state.
So the court documents, certain elements of the plan advanced by the monitor in February violate the Collective Bargaining Act. Certain elements of the plan may strip or may in the future strip plaintiffs of the protections of the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act and plaintiffs' ability to represent members of their respective bargaining units as defined by the law severely and unlawfully impacted by the actions of the defendants, the monitors in this case, and the plan. What's your sense of timing here? When do you want this judge to rule, this King County Superior Court judge to rule?
You know, our legal team is keeping us appraised of that. I mean, there's no rush. You know, the monitoring team is going to be here for probably a number of years, so there is no rush. I would like it as soon as possible so that we can all be very clear on the laws of the state and moving forward. And, you know, and I guess I hold out hope that, you know, again, we'll do it the Seattle way and everybody will just get in a room and discuss it. And then we can remove things from court and we can handle it that way.
And remove things from the monitor's plan, right?
Just make it clear to the monitor that any changes he wants to make that involve a mandatory subject will be first brought to the bargaining table, successfully bargained, and then implemented in that order.
Sergeant Rich O'Neill is Seattle Police Officers Guild president. The Police Officers Guild and the Seattle Police Management Association have filed asking for a declaratory judgment action by a King County Superior Court judge. By the way, have you talked to monitors since this action was taken, and have you heard a response?
You know, I have not spoken to Mr. Bob. I know he's been very busy the last couple of days. I sent him an email and appraised him of this action, but I have not heard back.
All right, Rich O'Neill, thank you.
Okay.
I appreciate you taking the time. You're listening to Weekday on KUOW.
The Curious Fates of Famous Corpses in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Third Place Books. Scientist John Marsluff teams up with artist Tony Angel in his book, Gifts of the Crow, from Atria. He discusses and reads on Tuesday, March 12th at 7 p.m. at Third Place Books in the Lake Forest Parktown Center.
54 degrees in Seattle. The clouds are expected to stick around all day. It'll be breezy with rain at times and a predicted high of 55. Tomorrow's high, 58. It's almost spring. Temperatures are rising. Daffodils are blooming. I even saw some chard growing in the flower boxes of a local bank. So you want to start growing things, but you're wondering what to plant and when and where to plant it. Get some ideas from our panel of expert gardeners in 20 minutes.
Yeah, planting things. That's what we're talking about today. In this case, corpses. We love celebrity and we are fascinated by death. The two things that came together for you, Katie Sewell?
Yeah. Local author Beth Lovejoy writes about what she said, calls dead people and forgotten history. And yesterday she came in. She just compiled a book of all these different stories called Rest in Pieces, The Curious Fates of Famous Corpses. And I started the conversation at the very beginning of the book. In the introduction, Beth Lovejoy writes that how you live has something to do with how you die. And so I asked her to give us an example of that from the book.
people have asked me about this a lot, and I don't think it's a straight relationship where if you're a good person, you have, you know, an easy time afterwards, and if you're a bad person, terrible things happen to you. But there's definitely certain relationships, and one of them, one of the things that struck me the most when I was writing was about all of the awful things that have happened to political corpses. So when you're a really divisive figure in life, especially when you've, you know, led a revolution or you have a very controversial form of government, after your death, you know, your corpse can become a pretty potent symbol. And sometimes, like what's happening now with Hugo Chavez, if the regime is continuing on, you're basically deified and you can be put on display forever. But if it's somebody like Mussolini, where you die and your regime is being toppled, then your corpse can suffer a lot of abuse.
You have a great story. I know you, in the book, you talk about Hitler and you talk about Lincoln. Is there one of those toppling stories that really stands out?
Well, Hitler is really interesting just because there was so much controversy over what did happen to him, and there still isn't a straight narrative either about how he died or what happened to his body afterwards. And it took a lot of research just to try to even figure out one coherent version of the story. It sounds like what ended up happening is the body that Russians believed to be his was moved around multiple times in what used to be Eastern Germany before it was finally cremated fully and his ashes were thrown into a river. But there's still a lot of debate about whether they got the right body.
Well, after doing all your research, how do you feel about what the United States did with Osama bin Laden?
That's really interesting. I mean, there was a lot of controversy from the Islamic community, and I can't speak to whether they were adequately respectful of what should have happened in that case, because that's pretty complicated. From a political point of view, burial at sea is probably pretty smart, because you definitely want to prevent the creation of any kind of resting place that can become a shrine, which is what has happened with Saddam Hussein, and actually with Mussolini's grave now, where there's neo-fascists who come and rally at his grave. So if you really want to try to prevent someone's political legacy from spreading, the best thing to do is make sure there's no gravesite at all.
Speaking with Beth Lovejoy, who's a writer, researcher, and editor based in Seattle, and her new book is Rest in Pieces, The Curious Fates of Famous Corpses. Well, you mentioned Hugo Chavez being put on permanent display, just like Lenin or Ho Chi Minh is. In light of that, mm-hmm. Do you have an opinion about that decision?
Well, I would be really interested to know whether it was something that he wanted to have happen and how his family felt about it. I haven't had a chance to do too much research into that, but I suspect that it was probably a decision made by, you know, the political movers and shakers behind him. It's probably not the best use of funds. It's a fairly expensive thing to put somebody on display, you know, for the foreseeable future and to embalm them permanently. And it's a pretty tricky thing to carry off. So if I were them, I would definitely think twice about doing it.
Well, in your book, you also tell a similar story of Eva Perón, mm-hmm. better known as Evita to everybody who's listening, probably. Hers is an interesting story. What happened to her body, body after she died?
Yeah, she's one of the ones I've been thinking about ever since the Chavez news came out. And she's probably a good cautionary tale. So she was, you know, as people will know if they've ever seen the movie Evita or the musical, she was incredibly popular, and she died of cancer when I think she was only about 33. And it was, the nation was just completely overcome with mourning. And her husband, Juan Perón, decided to have her permanently embalmed by this very talented Spanish embalmer. But almost as soon as the embalming was done, he was deposed in a coup and fled the country and left her body there with the embalmer, who kind of kept watch over it. And the new regime sort of let him, you know, do his thing for a little while. They didn't really believe that it was real, and they ended up actually cutting off one of her fingers to try to see if it really was a human body, because they were Catholic. And so they couldn't just burn her. They had to give her a proper burial, and they ended up burying her secretly in Italy.
Did they not think she was real because she looked so plastic?
Yeah, she looked very sort of waxen and plastic and like a little doll.
But they gave her a proper burial, but then didn't she come back up again?
Yeah. Well, they tried several times to bury her. And there's a story, it's a bit complicated, but there's a story that one of the generals who tried to bury her actually went insane and ended up keeping her body in the attic of his office. But after that, they did give her a secret burial under a different name in Italy. But they eventually, when Juan Perón came back to Argentina, they did bring her body back, and she finally got, a decent burial many feet underground in a famous cemetery in Argentina. And supposedly her grave now can withstand a nuclear bomb. So,
what do you think of the act of trying to preserve somebody forever as a researcher into this topic?
I really try not to make value judgments about this kind of thing, but it seems I'm more a fan of people facing up to their inevitable demise and decay. And I think it's, as I was saying with Chavez, probably not a very good use of resources. It's a fairly toxic thing to undertake. I don't know if Lenin, I think, is the corpse that has been preserved the longest with chemical means, as opposed to some kind of like natural mummification. And it's a pretty hard thing to do. So I would say I'm not a huge fan, no.
Throughout this book, as you work your way through history, there's a lot of different traditions that sort of rise up that we no longer have that would be unfamiliar to modern people.
Definitely.
One about, renouncing what you did as a profession right before you die so that you can be buried in a different place than you would be buried otherwise. Or throughout the whole book, you have stories of people collecting certain parts of their loved ones or somebody that they admire, whether it be scientists or, a family member. Let's talk about that tradition of collecting people's body parts. Is there a good story, first off, to tell about somebody who did that?
Well, the two that come to mind are probably Mary Shelley and Joseph Haydn. And the story with Mary Shelley, which might be familiar to some listeners, is that after her husband, the poet Percy Shelley, died at sea, he was burned on the beach, according to local health regulations. But supposedly his heart didn't burn. And so a friend snatched it out of the flames and it eventually went to Mary Shelley, who kept it in her desk drawer, actually, until she died. And it ended up sort of being in this like brown and withered in this little pouch, and it was buried with her. So keeping your husband's heart is something that people would find pretty macabre today. So the story with the composer Joseph Haydn is very different from Mary Shelley, and it basically has to do with this quack pseudoscience of the 19th century called phrenology, which basically said that people's brains would change size and shape in accordance with their personality, and that would affect the size and shape of their skull. So essentially, you could pass your hands over someone's skull and read it the way you might, read a palm if you were into that sort of thing. And so you could look at your friend and say, well, they have a bump over their left ear, that means they're really talented at music. So, and this was very popular. So, unfortunately, it led to a whole series of famous skulls being stolen so that people could study them and try to figure out what they said about the person while they were still alive. And some good friends of Joseph Haydn's stole his skull right after his death. They bribed the gravedigger to unearth it. They gave it to a friend who worked at a hospital to boil it clean, get it down to, this clean, white, beautiful specimen. And then it went on display in one of their houses. And the police found out about it, tried to get the skull back. The friend gave a decoy skull. And it basically took, I think, about a century for Joseph Haydn's real skull to get back into his grave. And supposedly his tomb in Austria now actually has two skulls inside of it, the real one and the decoy one.
Well, that's always the challenge, too, when you're moving bones around and body parts around, is how do you get them back all together,
right,
if
yes.
ever, right? Another story you told was of, you have a section called Love and Devotion that's about, people going above and beyond to try to take care of the corpse of their loved one or save a piece of the corpse of their loved one. And one of the stories that struck me was Thomas More and his daughter. I thought that would be a fun one to share.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story. It's one of the nice sort of father-daughter stories in the book. So when Thomas More was beheaded, his skull was put on a pike on Westminster Bridge, I believe it was, and it stayed there for some amount of time. And then, he wasn't the only head on that bridge. They would put the heads of all kinds of, traitors and criminals on spikes on the bridge, if you can believe that. And then as new heads came along, they would move the old ones down and eventually just, throw them into the Thames. So the story is that his daughter, Meg, came along in a boat and probably bribed the bridge keeper to kind of toss the skull over the bridge and into her lap. She kept it, she preserved it with spices, and she asked for it to be buried in her arms.
Bess Lovejoy is a writer, researcher, editor based in Seattle. Her book is Rest in Pieces, The Curious Fates of Famous Corpses. And if you want to see her speak, she is speaking tonight at the Rendezvous at 7 p.m. So you cover a lot of different types of people in this book, from Voltaire to actor John Barrymore. How did you decide who you were going to choose? Because there's a lot of famous people, and you never know what road you're going down until you start the research.
Right. And people keep dying. You know, I mean, Osama bin Laden, that happened after the book was sold and while I was in the writing and research process. I let it sort of happen organically. You know, I started doing the research just by going into bookstores and libraries and into the biography section and just flipping into the last pages and trying to figure out what had happened to people who I admired personally. So I sort of started looking at famous writers, musicians, and artists, people who were sort of intellectual heroes of mine. One of the first stories that I came across was Dorothy Parker's, and I thought it was really fascinating how she'd left her whole estate to Martin Luther King and then how her ashes ended up in a filing cabinet. But after I'd assembled a good group of these immortal minds, is how I was thinking about it, mortal fates of immortal minds, I realized that the book would be more interesting if I broadened it out. And that's when I started looking at celebrities and politicians, etc. And I don't know, I just kept researching until I felt like I had a good collection of stories and ones that were longer stories, not just one fact.
Why tell these stories?
That's a good question. Well, I think part of it is it seems for those of us who have a bit of a morbid sense of humor, it can be a real delight. And I think that there's value in just delight and a certain kind of absurd black humor that I hope this this book conveys. I also found when I was researching it, and I hope this comes across in the book, that realizing that these figures were actually, you know, human beings who were made of flesh and blood and lived and died can actually be kind of inspiring because it helps us realize that, you know, they're not deities and the things that they accomplish are possible for us as well. And it just helps us figure out another way of relating to them and understanding the cultural context of their times. And I also think that there's value in kind of, as I was saying earlier, confronting, you know, the fate that all of us share. If you can approach that with humor, I think it sort of leavens the horror of the whole thing. And I hope that this book does that a little bit.
I'm curious for you personally, when you were a child growing up, do you remember when you first noticed death? Since it's been a longtime interest of yours?
I don't remember when I first noticed death, but I certainly remember being about, you know, 15, 16, 17, and really thinking a lot about the fact that I was going to die and kind of wondering why people weren't talking about it more, because there was definitely a lot of emphasis on all of the horrible ways that you could die, kind of violence and gore. But the fact of everyone's mortality and just sort of talking about whether they were really, you know, are you really doing what you want to do? Because you do understand that this is finite, right? People didn't seem to be talking about that very much.
It seems so different when reading the histories in this book of the different people that you cover, how different our attitudes have come to be.
Definitely.
Where do you think the best spot for improvement would be, just as a researcher, as far as how we consider mortality?
Well, as I was saying earlier, I try not to make value judgments about what people do with their bodies. So in certain traditions, keeping, you know, your husband's skull around is a good thing to do. In certain traditions, embalming them is good to do. So I don't tend to think about the treatment of dead bodies that much, although I do have some wonderful friends in the funeral industry who've made me more aware about the need for green burial. But what I tend to think more about is just the value of people approaching their own mortality and thinking about that more.
Now, you decided to end the book with the story of Hunter S. Thompson. Why did you choose to end with him?
Well, a little secret about the book is that I originally wrote it chronologically, and he was originally the last person, the most recent person. And I kind of developed this idea when I was writing it that it was interesting to see the transition towards this very individualistic way of dealing with death. So the closer we get to the modern era, to me, it seemed like the more control people have over their own corpses. And with Hunter S. Thompson, you know, he decided several decades before he died that he wanted this to happen. And he
What did he want to have happen?
And what he wanted to have happen was he wanted to build a giant column in his backyard, which is on a ranch out in Colorado. And the column is topped with his gonzo fist, which is his personal symbol. And it's a fist clutching a peyote button. And inside the gonzo fist is a cannon that would shoot and did shoot his cremated remains mixed with fireworks over this valley near his house. And he had Mr. Tambourine Man play and hundreds of his closest friends just have an all-night party and celebrate. And so that was part of why I also enjoyed ending the book that way, because I liked ending it on a celebratory note.
Bess Lovejoy is a writer, researcher, editor based in Seattle. Her book that we've been talking about is called Rest in Pieces, The Curious Fate of Famous Corpses. She also writes about, you know, dead people, forgotten history, sometimes art, literature, science. And if you want to see her read from the book in person, tonight is the night, rendezvous at 7 p.m. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Katie.
This is Weekday.
Bess Lovejoy spoke with KUOW's Katie Sewell. Ten 40. Free expert gardening advice in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Good Business Network, presenting the semi-annual Dine Around Seattle, featuring three-course dinners of appetizer, entree, and dessert at local area restaurants. Sundays through Thursdays, March 3rd through 28th. More details online at dinearoundseattle.org.
Mostly cloudy sky over Seattle, currently 53 degrees. Forecast says breezy and cloudy all day with rain at times and a high of 55. Overnight, rain at times, low of 48, and tomorrow, Wednesday, guess what? Rain at times with a high of 58.
KUOW and Seattle Repertory Theater present Good People, a comedy of class and culture. Life is hard in South Boston, and Margie is out of luck. An encounter with her high school sweetheart leaves her wondering if life is about choice or chance. Playing March 8th through the 31st. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:41. A look at the issues of college costs, loan debt, and financial aid in 30 minutes.
Daffodils are blooming. Temperatures are going up. Crocuses are all over the place. Dead leaves from last year? Well, what should you do with them? Deborah Prinzig is a writer, lecturer, flower expert. That's a nice little phrase. I'm a flower expert. Author of The 50 Mile Bouquet, Seasonal, Local, and Sustainable Flowers. Good to see you.
Thank you.
And her latest, Slow Flowers, Four Seasons of Locally Grown Bouquets from the Garden, Meadow, and Farm. I'm sorry, Slow Flowers. You're really impatient.
You have to say it really slowly.
Slow flowers.
They're not very smart flowers.
They're slow flowers. Marty Wingate writes about garden and travel. You can find her work at martywingate.com. Landscaping for Privacy is her book, and she has handed me a very small type first chapter of The Garden Plot, A Potting Shed Mystery by Marty Wingate. That's nice.
Thank you.
That's very exciting.
Make sure you have your reading glasses on.
Yeah, and a magnifying glass for this font. The book will not have font.
No, the book will be fine.
And Greg Rayburn is the Vashon Basin Steward. He works on habitat restoration. I was on your fair island, Vashon, on Sunday night doing a talk with former president of Lehrer NewsHour for the community club there. And then when I left, I was driving back to the ferry, I stopped for a moment in the dark, wooded part of that lovely island, and the frogs were just loud. You live in a veritable paradise, a little green island amidst the concrete.
Shh, don't tell anyone.
Just think if they had built those bridges.
Yeah.
They had built the bridges at the south end and the north end, what Vashon would be like.
It would no longer be an island.
Yeah. It would be Manhattan.
So were you at Island Center Forest?
Yes.
Is that the...
Yeah. No. No.
Shingle Mill Creek?
Blue Heron Gallery?
You weren't drinking beer?
No.
Don't you usually drink beer when you do
this?
No,
that's
talks?
Different.
Oh, okay.
All right. Enough of that. I just... Since I asked Greg if he had anything particular to say, and he said plant native plants. Many native plants on that island.
Yes. Yes, but we can always use more variety. Because it's been logged over and disturbed, we end up with a lot of salmonberry and alder. But by having more of a diversity of native plants, those are great plants, but by adding more variety, you can support even more and more species of wildlife.
What native tree if it had was all over Vashon right now, would we be seeing in early glory? Because I don't know if it'd be blossoming or not.
No, not really. I mean, we're starting. Yeah, it's still a little early for most trees.
I'm just giving you an opportunity to talk about some of your favorite trees.
Seeing a lot of current, right?
Well, when we're talking shrubs, the Indian plum right now is prolific.
I just was hoping for a tree, but okay.
A tree?
Don't you like some hard? What's the one he likes? Hardhack? That's not.
Well, the native crabapple. It's not blooming yet. Native cherries aren't really out yet, so we're still. Although the willows. Lots of willows blooming right now, which
all
are
right.
Nice.
A native willow.
Yes.
All right. There we go. And you're saying cleanup right now.
I'm doing late winter cleanup, which is substituting for late fall cleanup or early winter cleanup.
Well, you left it for the birds.
I did, and I felt a little bad about it. That brick raised bed that we see out of our kitchen windows is a late season bed, and so I leave everything over the winter. The Lemon Queen sunflower stalks, the Duchess of Albany clematis, mass of dead leaves, because the birds hop around in it. And I finally did cut all that back, so we're ready for new growth, and all of the ornamental onions are coming up.
And what'd you do with your sword ferns?
I know this is the time of year that Greg thinks I'm crazy one of the times of year. Because in
a
small garden, I like to have, well, now if you've seen my garden, you would laugh at this. I like to have things looking as neat as possible. And so I cut back the sword ferns, which are evergreen, I realize that, all of the polystichum that I have.
You cut them, what do you cut off? Everything?
I cut off the old fronds because you can see it's like a fist waiting at the base. All of the new fronds will come out, look so lovely and fresh and dark green and glossy. And so that'll carry us through the whole year. And I only wait until now because they're starting to grow.
Why is that wrong?
Well, in my yard, it's wrong.
Why is she crazy?
I have too many other things to do. But
and because
you have
such a huge property, it would take you forever to cut back the sword ferns.
But mainly because that's in my forested area, the mulch ring provided by those old fronds is great overwintering habitat for amphibians. So these little forest salamanders.
I waited until now.
That's where the frogs were.
That's right. Yeah. And the sword ferns.
Yeah. It's amazing how on native plant salvage events, when we go out and dig up shrubs before they're bulldozed, it's amazing how many amphibians you'll find in that frond ring.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. So that's where I should hunt.
Yeah. Why would you be hunting?
To look at them.
Oh, yes.
Not to hurt them. Not to hurt the little creatures, but, to see them.
Yeah.
All right. That's good to know.
Mm-hmm.
But what Marty does is okay for the urban gardener who's grooming her garden, right?
Oh, sure. It's not like you're going to kill them.
I got him on record. No, thank you, Deborah. I appreciate that. No, there's no killing them. That's for
sure. Could we get some amphibians into our urban gardens if we left the sword fern fronds?
That's probably a stretch in Marty's yard.
There you are.
Describe this lovely bouquet you have brought us, Deborah.
I thought, Steve, that I would clip from my garden this morning, which is the 5-step bouquet.
I am, by the way, not putting my nose into any of those flowers because this is a bad allergy season.
Oh, dear. I'm so sorry. Yeah. Well, I have a dark, beautiful dark ruby pink and a creamy white, two forms of Pieris japonica, which is also known as Lily of the Valley shrub or what else?
Andromeda is another old-fashioned name for it.
And it's just a pretty boring, nondescript shrub rest of the year, but in spring it is gorgeous.
And has a lovely sort of powdery, light powdery scent.
Why don't you put your nose in it?
And I have one in the garden. And so it seems to be one of those smells that you just get every once in a while. It's not like Daphne Odora.
It's not heavy. But they look like little chandelier droppings. And then I have some forsythia just starting to show its yellow buds, and it will open. And that's an old-fashioned forcing woody shrub that, you know, my grandmother brought in and put in vases when I was a kid. And then a little Daphne Odora, which is very perfumed, and designers like to place it by the front and back door so that you catch a whiff as you come and go.
Quiescent right now here. As it warms up, it'll probably start exuding more, do you think? Or am I just not sticking my nose close to it?
Well, they're small. I have a small shrub, but I mean, they've just opened. I smell them though, not from here, but when I'm in my car, they smelled great.
Oh, that's great. That's fun. What's a slow flower, by the way?
So the book... The book that I wrote, it just came out, and it was my... It's a play on slow food, which, of course, I think people in Seattle understand the whole idea of consuming our food very close to the source of where it was produced. And slow flowers, similarly, are all about living in the seasons and being local. So I set out to create a bouquet every week for 52 weeks all around the year and see if I could actually do it. Because, all you know, you get all this feedback from people saying, oh, yeah, you can be local if you live in Santa Barbara and you have access to flowers, you know, all year round. But you can't do that in Seattle.
What would you have had a month ago in a bouquet?
I do have cheats, Steve. But a month ago, I had my verbena, Pink Dawn, was exploding.
Yeah.
And I had that in a bouquet with pussy willows. Mm-hmm. But the cheats are that I use forest bulbs sometimes. And
you use flowers from florists that are grown in the Northwest.
I use
grown in the Northwest.
Yes, I use locally grown ingredients, and there are people with greenhouses. The tulips at the Pike Place Market are grown year-round in Bellingham.
And so, there's always salal and evergreen huckleberry.
I know, and I love using native ingredients, but I don't want to ruin the habitat, so I'm careful.
And sword fern fronds.
Yeah. But you probably want to use the fresh ones, not the... Those are the ones Marty is leaving.
All right. Well, what questions do you have at this march for our guests? 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. And I have some lines open. And you can email us weekday at kuow.org. This is right up your alleys. This is perfect. My sister is getting married this August, Sarah writes. The reception will be at my mom's rustic property. Mom wants to plant native flowering plants for landscaping and to cut for table settings and bouquets. What are some good choices to plant now for August flowering so the property will look its best? That's a good start. There's some hardy wild roses. There's thistles. There's a meadow.
Oh.
Where would you start?
Well, when I think of later summer bloomers, I generally think of goldenrod, which some people might have allergies to, so I'm not sure if that's an issue.
I will not be going near it.
I don't think that's true. I think that that's a
myth.
Yes.
Yeah.
Goldenrod?
Yeah.
We're not allergic to it?
No. Okay. And I don't think you'd be allergic to sneezeweed either.
Yeah.
These common names.
Yeah. And then also asters, some of the native asters, and there's also fleabanes, which are a type of aster, which would be another fall blooming perennial.
Is fleabane a plant that bans fleas? Is the bane of fleas?
Well, that is a...
It probably was. It's probably put in mattresses
or
something.
Yes, like sweet woodruff was used to sweeten the linens.
What's the botanical name of that?
Erigeron?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's so fascinating. Well, I'd like to do a whole study on the native flowering bouquet. Let's work on that together.
Yes, sounds like a plan.
I think the native wild roses would be wonderful. And I mean, depending on the time of year, the hips would be beautiful too, to add, you know, a little bit of texture besides, and I think anything fruiting would be fantastic.
Anything fruiting?
I like to put unripe berries in my bouquets so that in August you could be harvesting some cool huckleberries and what else? Currants.
Yeah.
Currants are gorgeous in bouquets. So
Indian plum, right?
Yeah. I want
to
see
photos. They'll probably be gone by then.
Yeah.
Eaten by the birds.
Yes.
Snowberries.
It's a little late for some of the spring flowers. There are a lot of spring flowering native plants, camas and...
Yeah. That's too late.
It's interesting. The snowberries are being grown commercially now for the cut flower trade because they are so fantastic as a cut, the white ones and the pink forms.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. All right. Anything to add? Is that her bouquet? Anything to add to that?
How about grasses? Can we add some grasses, Greg?
Yeah.
Native grasses?
Add bear grass.
Yeah, how about, bear grass is great.
Nice.
And also dyschampsia.
And I would also, I love for weddings to see any kind of flowering vine, just to add a little bit of kind of old-fashioned romance.
All right. You got work to do now, Sarah. Get out there and start planting. And she can start thinking about the planting now, yeah?
Oh, yeah, I'd get them in the ground as soon as possible.
All right. Kirk's in Woodinville. Hi, Kirk.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for sharing our airwaves. And I've got kind of a post facto question. Hopefully I didn't do any damage after the fact here. But I have some kind of unique shrubs called phagelius. And this is the first year that they needed to be pruned back. And I treated them basically like roses, where I pruned them down, I would say probably 12, 18 inches from the ground up. The branches were originally about 3 feet. Is that okay?
This is Phygelius, you said?
Yeah.
And did it keep a lot of its leaves over the winter?
It did, but they were, probably 50% brown.
Yeah,
And dead.
It does. It's sort of semi-evergreen in our area. I would say that you could cut that Phygelius back as hard as you want to, and you're not going to do any damage to it. It is a robust grower. And you may find, if you have it in the ground, after about 5 years, I didn't believe this. Mine was in the ground 5 years, and I read, oh, this thing suckers all over the place. And I thought, well, how silly. Mine's not suckering at all. Oh, I just had to wait one more year. And then I get little runners coming up here and there. But it's a tough shrub. The hummingbirds love it. And it blooms for a very long time.
Spell it. What is it?
Phygelius.
Oh.
By aggressively pruning, does that promote more dense width of the shrub?
It will, so you can see where the leaves come out of the stem, and you will get, what I would do is, if you want to create a denser shrub, when it grows and then blooms, if you would cut that finished bloom back a few inches, maybe even halfway down the stem, you'll get two stems emerging from that cut. So you will make it, it will be thicker looking that way.
Cape fuchsia.
Mm-hmm, Cape fuchsia.
All right, Kirk, thanks. Let me see what Judy wants to know about her roses. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I have a very old rose bush that has been bloomed. It's one of those like peace roses, and they grow to like 10 feet tall. But it has black spot on it. Now, it's had black spot for several years, and it still continues to thrive, it seems. We cut it way, way, way back to like maybe 3 feet this spring. And I'm wondering, and it's starting to get some new leaves on it, but I'm wondering, it's very woody at the bottom and kind of not pretty. I'm wondering if I'm just better off saying thank you very much for your beauty while you lasted and just going with something new.
By the way, that was a cool sound.
That was.
And I don't know where it came from. What should she do? Thanks. Thank it.
I lean toward the side of replacing it. And because they do look a little awful, really, really old roses. And if you go with an own root rose, then you, a rose that is not grafted, then you, once it's established and it sends fresh stems up from the ground, you never have to worry what it is. It's always the rose you chose. And there are some great disease-resistant roses out there. What would you plant?
Well, that's what I was thinking, is the disease-resistant roses are more forgiving for our area. I'm personally smitten with all of the David Austin mm-hmm. roses. Abraham Darby is one of my main men. I love him.
Yeah.
Is that a rose or a creator of roses? Darby.
I've never looked up to see who he is, but that's a cultivar of a David Austin rose.
From
but
literature
kind of
somewhere, he likes to do that. Strawberry yeah. Hill. I have Strawberry Hill, and it's lovely. And the nice thing about David Austin roses, English-style roses, that's what they're called, when they come out with new ones every year, I did not realize this until Michael Moriarty told us this, who works for David Austin. They take away a few older roses that over the years they've decided are not as good as some of the others. So their catalog is full of current really good roses to grow, and they don't keep the ones that have, after 10 years, they've decided are not as good as they were.
Okay, real quick, how would you, what about pruning hydrangeas right now? Is it time?
Yeah, cut it back to where you see the new buds.
How about katsura trees? Can we prune now? Is it okay to prune them?
I just pruned mine, my weeping katsura, just to fix the architecture. It was getting a little crowded there with crossing branches. But I think it's fine to cut out any damaged or rubbing branches at this point. What would you say, Greg?
I agree.
And what are you planting right now?
Oh, I'm going through. I just put in some goat's beard, which I was excited to get out of its container. It's I'm down to 300 peanuts left. I'm making progress. So,
Okay. Abraham Darby played in a, his family played an important role in the Industrial Revolution. The Darbys invented coke smelting and advanced the mass production of brass and iron goods. And is,
wow.
is now has a rose named after them.
So that's funny.
That should just be part of how we look at all this. Marty Wingate, Greg Rayburn, Deborah Prinzing, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks
happy
to you.
Gardening.
You too.
And you folks have a happy gardening time. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amin El-Sadi, Andy Hurst, Bernard Ouellette, our engineer, and your host the rest of the morning and the afternoon. Have a good day.
10:59. Looks like it'll be a little while before we see calorie counts on menus. The head of the FDA says that writing the new menu labeling law has gotten extremely thorny. We'll learn more about those thorns in a moment. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Children's Theater's production of Adventures with Spot. Eric Hill's picture books come to life when Spot the puppy is accompanied by original music and puppetry, March 21st through April 28th. Tickets and information at sct.org.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.